Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and this week the trial of eight former employees of Rupert Murdoch's News of the World began in the UK. The defendants, who include two of Britain's most high-profile former newspaper editors, Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson, are accused of bribery and intercepting voicemail messages. Accusations being made by the prosecution already read like a crime thriller novel, including affairs and cover-ups, and it's only week one of the trial. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has just released a book called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. He's here to decode the trial and to explain how News of the World fits into the broader culture of Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. Hey, David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First, a little piece of history from your book.
Sure.
That I didn't know, that Time Warner Cable initially refused to carry Fox News Channel in New York, correct?
That's right. At the time, Time Warner's empire included both Time Warner Cable and CNN. And they saw this as a competitor and, you know, thought to deny Rupert Murdoch this opportunity to compete with them in the largest market in the country would be a good idea.
What year was that?
I believe it was 1996 when they were launching, you know, roughly at the same time as MSNBC. They sought to get it on here in New York. And it took the intervention of Mayor Rudy Giuliani to make it happen. Now, look, I mean, from our standpoint, if you think about Comcast trying to keep off a competitor to NBC these days, you'd say, hey, that's kind of dirty pool. It's all should all come down to money. It shouldn't just be allowed to deny a competitor a place. At the same time, a federal judge found that Rudy Giuliani's aides worked in such collaboration with Roger Ailes' aides at Fox News and people at News Corp to get that channel on the air that it functioned as a form of collusion. Giuliani, you may recall, turned over public access airwaves that belonged to the city to both Fox News, and they threw in the fledgling Bloomberg TV as a way of throwing a bone to say, well, it's not just about Fox, it's a larger issue.
And by the way, Time Warner Cable is now, I gather for money rather than ideology reasons, refusing to carry the new Al Jazeera America. So it's funny that in one instance they did it to Fox, and in another instance they're doing it to Al Jazeera.
I think they just reached an agreement to carry
them. Oh, they did?
Them.
Did they really?
So it's going to work out in New York, Los Angeles, and Dallas, I believe. But it's been a slow slog for Al Jazeera.
So you write that News Corp and the Murdoch family not only chose not to participate in the preparation of your book, they also, quote, actively discouraged others from doing so. What were some of the challenges of reporting this story?
Well, you know, News Corp and now its sister company, 21st Century Fox, can be very controlling. So, for example, I was about to sit down one day with a very senior executive at News Corp for a long-planned interview. And before I got there, I got a call to say essentially that a senior aide to Mr. Murdoch had called this person and said, don't do this. We don't want you cooperating. You know, months and months ahead of time, I made clear to the Murdoch aides what I was interested in doing. I hope to sit down with them, and they tried to prevent that. You know, mirrored, of course, with Fox, which is its own brand of information management.
And what were you interested in doing? There's been so much said about the Murdoch media empire, and it has its fans, it has its detractors, ideologically, ethically, all these other things. What were you trying to add to the well-told story of Rupert Murdoch?
Well, I think a couple of things. First off, he's been, I think, a singular force of disruption and creation in the world of media, media larger than journalism, but particularly in journalism. You know, he introduced in this country a journalism much more based on Anglo and Australian traditions than on ones that we're familiar with, and we can talk about those more. But also it seemed to me that, he had acquired the Wall Street Journal, the jewel in the crown, one of these great, not only American, but global news organizations. And the stories that had been told about him sort of ended with that acquisition. The hacking scandal in London, which I think can be directly traced to the kind of culture that he created in newsrooms there, I think offered us an entirely new window to think about that culture and to reassess what we understood about that man, how that came to be, how it came to pass.
You say that he created there. Andrew Edis, one of the prosecutors in this ongoing trial, said, quote, in the dog-eat-dog world of journalism, in this frenzy to get this huge story and to try to get something better or at least as good as what everyone else has got, this is what you do. You hack the competition. This is a phone hacking scandal. So is it just that news and tabloid culture are different in the UK?
Well, I think tabloid culture is different in the United Kingdom and again, different in Australia. You know, one of the things, the reasons I took a look at Murdoch's world is that you have this same DNA playing out in these three related cultures in Australia, the US, the UK, almost essentially cousins. And they evolve differently as cousins do, but they carry similar traits and similar strains. In the UK, the tabloid culture was unbelievably competitive, almost venomously tough. One of the reasons for that is, unlike our own, it really is a national newspaper market. You know, Britain's a relatively compact nation, and it's a, you know, a commuter nation, and they read papers and they pick it up not typically as subscribers, but on the newsstand. So each day you have to come up with a new headline, a new photograph, a new revelation to do that. And it was always incredibly intense. In addition, you know, the emergence of the digital sphere since 96 has meant that they've not only had to compete with each other, they've had to compete with all these websites. And so people have described it as feral, you know, the dog-eat-world nature of it. Steve Coogan, the comedian and actor, he said, look, they're amoral. He says, they're not doing this because they hate me. They're doing this because this is what it serves them to do. Among the people hacked, Rebecca Brooks, you think about, she's the former head of Murdoch's newspaper arm in the UK. She's the former editor-in-chief of both the Sun tabloid and the News of the World, now closed. She is in the dock on charges of obstruction of justice, of conspiracy to commit essentially corruption, bribery, and also the phone hacking of voicemail messages on people's cell phones. Her own phone was hacked by her former reporters for her tabloid when she was going through a rough spot in her earlier marriage to a guy who starred in a British soap opera. They just were doing it to everybody at the time. At least let me say this. Some people have pleaded guilty to this, and the prosecutors are making that very case. It certainly seems, in the words of former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, a guy who spent time sucking up to the Murdoch empire, that hacking was occurring on an industrial scale.
And listeners, if you have any questions for NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, whose new book is Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-WNYC. 9692. Call us up if you've listened to David Folkenflik's reporting on NPR and would like this chance to talk to him, especially about his book, Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. By the way, about Rebecca Brooks and David Cameron sucking up to the Murdoch empire, Brooks is married to a schoolmate of Prime Minister David Cameron.
That's right.
And Andy Coulson became a top aide to Mr. Cameron after he left the News of the World. So there seems to be a very incestuous relationship between the Murdoch empire and the highest levels of the British government from whichever party.
Oh, and that's exactly right, and it's been going back decades. But I think the key to Murdoch's singularity in the media sphere, both in this country, particularly in the UK, also Australia, is that although he is himself a conservative figure with strong political beliefs, he's willing to swing the support of his newspapers from people on the right to the kind of center left. So Hillary Clinton in this country got support for her Senate bid for the New York Post. You know, Murdoch said, we can do business with this woman. You know, similarly, Tony Blair, you know, sought to try to win Murdoch away from the conservatives whom he had supported, Margaret Thatcher. Murdoch became disenchanted with John Major. But think about how these guys did it. You know, Tony Blair could have met Rupert Murdoch in London at one of Murdoch's residences there. No. He flies to a small island off the coast of Australia to address News Corp executives in 1995, showing he's willing to travel the world to do it. Gordon Brown did the same thing to Idaho. David Cameron, while in opposition to the Conservative Party, hoping to win the support of the Murdoch press back to the Conservative Party, flew on Murdoch's son-in-law's jet. On his way to the Middle East, he stopped off at the Greek island of Santorini and talked with Murdoch and sort of dined with him on his yacht to indicate, I will do business to you. The way one Murdoch aide described it to me was coming to kiss the ring. And people in Australia, the future prime ministers, did the same thing, no matter whether or not they loved him or hated him.
So were you ever intimidated while researching this book? I mean, not only were you up against a huge media tycoon, you also knew that News Corp employees are quite capable of hacking fellow journalists.
Well, I think if any hacking were to occur in this country, you of anyone, you would see the wrath of federal authorities in this country come down hard on the News Corp empire. They are watching carefully what's occurring in Britain. They are deferring, in a sense. You know, there's this thing called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's illegal for an American company to pay bribes abroad, and it doesn't matter how small the bribes are. The bribes in Britain seem to be mostly in the thousands or maybe a couple tens of thousands of pounds. So the feds are saying, look, the British authorities are dealing with this severely. There seems to have been significant cooperation with authorities there. So far, they have not engaged in their own prosecutions. They had done that to me. They'd done that to somebody else here. That would be a real problem.
But you say there versus here. But wasn't it revealed that News of the World employees tried to bribe a former New York City police officer to hack into electronic phone records of all people, 9/11 victims?
There was that allegation, and also the Daily Mirror alleged in a report that summer of 2011 that Jude Law's phone had been hacked. There had been this allegation floating about that somehow his phone had been hacked while going through JFK.
Why Jude Law?
They're very interested in Jude Law. He is a British performer, after all. And, you know, his former wife, Sienna Miller, is also a Brit. They've been focusing on their marital woes and their domestic discord during their marriage and breakup for quite some time.
You also write that the scandal tabloids like News of the World and The Sun provide the financial base that Murdoch needed to purchase two of the UK's most respected papers, I should say, provided the base before he made the purchase of the Times of London and the Sunday Times. So to what extent did Murdoch need those tabloids to make those acquisitions? And now that the News of the World is gone as a result of the scandal, how is that affecting his ability to do things like that?
Well, you know, Margaret Thatcher was in office at the time, and he essentially needed her to not worry about whether or not having four of the nation's largest national newspapers would somehow signal too large a concentration of power of the media in one guy. And she basically they talked about it in Parliament and decided not to refer it to various regulatory agencies, which allowed it to speed through. It may well have been the best offer that the owners of the Times of London, the Sun and Times, could get for it and to keep those papers together. And Murdoch has subsidized those papers, the Times of London and the Times Literary Supplement in particular, despite the fact of losses since. Having those tabloids allowed him to have the leverage to do that and the ability to exercise influence that at key moments becomes power. He controlled, just at the height of the scandal, 40% of Britain's national newspaper circulation. And as I said, it's a national market for newspapers. Now, you know, actually, it's only down by several percent because they created The Sun on Sunday, a sister paper to The Sun tabloid. So he's lost a bit, and certainly he's bruised, but he still has significant play. The difference is that politicians, instead of rushing to embrace him, have been recoiling from the Murdoch embrace. Don't forget David Cameron, on his first day in office, the very first private individual he received at 10 Downing Street was Rupert Murdoch. He did ask Mr. Murdoch to arrive and leave by the back door so that photographers would not capture that moment.
Powerful but shameful in that telling of the story. David Folkenflik, author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, and Brendan in Fairfield. You're on WNYC. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
All right.
I was wondering, when it comes to news coverage, I know that, a lot of companies shy away from covering certain stories or certain news that is deemed harmful to them if they are going to try to get somebody interviewed later on. And how does that affect the news coverage that we do end up getting?
Well, I think, there's a thing called access journalism, and there are people who try to avoid, I think, punching hard on certain kinds of stories and hope that maybe they'll just land one of the key figures at the center of it. You see this particularly in the morning shows in broadcast networks. Good Morning America, Today Show are vying for access. And sometimes you can discern some storylines not being explored in that way. You know, the way in which the tabloids deal with this is the Murdoch tabloids in particular are more likely to punish you until you agree to sit down and you relent to them. They're less in the currying favor business, although they're capable of it, and more in the more in sort of a punitive approach to journalism at times.
How about the relationship between Murdoch's ideology and Murdoch's business interests? Is he conservative, and are so many of his news outlets conservatives to reflect his personal beliefs and values, or are they conservative because by promoting those kinds of values and beliefs, Rupert Murdoch is going to make more money?
I think the only answer to that question is yes. You know, I think if you look at it, Murdoch is definitely a conservative figure, and he's right of center, unquestionably. He's against government regulation. He's against certain kinds of taxation. He's culturally conservative at his core. At the same time, he's not rigidly partisan, as, you know, I think it's important to remember that he shifts back and forth in a way that, you know, you're not going to see Roger Ailes' folks openly endorsing Democrats too often, the opinion leaders, their large figures on Fox News. Fox News and the Wall Street Journal's editorial page are more conservative than Mr. Murdoch himself. And there's a pragmatism that associates with that. It is better for his business interests, for politicians of both parties in these three countries in which he's so influential and powerful, to be able to think that they're going to go back and forth, that he's going to go back and forth. That's a way he can exercise influence on both parties. So his business interests are served by his pragmatism, his conservatism reflected in the Australian papers. It's a populist center-right punching up at elites. There's a resentment that's cultivated. It's very similar to what you see on Fox News in terms of the cultural sensibility. He's just, you know, he's a little bit to their left on things like immigration and some other social issues.
A media colleague of mine speculated recently that Rupert Murdoch may drop the New York Post, that the New York Post may actually go out of business because it loses many, many, many dollars per year for Rupert Murdoch. And he may he may be coming to the point where he decides he doesn't need it. Have you heard anything like that?
Well, he said he's committed to it. I think one of the reasons why he jettisoned his pet project, The Daily, which was this native tablet publication coming out every day, run by Jesse Angelo, was to show investors that he was serious about cutting costs, because that wasn't being given the resources they put a lot of money into it, but they didn't see a path to profitability, and they started cutting that. And at a certain point, it just wasn't going to flourish. Jesse Angelo is now the publisher and effectively the editor-in-chief of the New York Post. He loves reading the Post. He loves having a place at the table. It is worth it for him to sustain losses between, call it, $75 and $95 million a year to have a place for the table, you know. Hillary Clinton as a Senate candidate is not going to need him as much if she doesn't look to the pages of the New York Post as a sympathetic place.
He's got the Wall Street Journal here in New York, too.
He does, and the Wall Street Journal now has a daily report. But if, you know, under oath in Britain, when he was asked about his beliefs, he says, you know, if you want to understand what I think, you should look in the pages of The Sun. And I've talked to tabloid editors who said The Sun and the New York Post, both of them are good representations of what he thinks, of who he is, of where he stands.
So is there any implication for Rupert Murdoch's power in the United States from how this trial in the UK turns out?
I think, well, you have a very powerful senator, Jay Rockefeller. He's stepping down in about a year and a half, but nonetheless, who's very interested in the questions of the possible offenses they're committed at a corporate level. You know, federal authorities, both at the Justice Department and the Securities and Exchange Commission, could, I'm not saying they will, but could decide that because of what appear to be infractions of federal corruption laws, that they need to take a look at them, too. There could be a notion that there needs to be a restriction of how many stations he owns. He owns far more stations than used to be allowed under federal laws and regulations. He's been operating this one that serves New Jersey sort of under a waiver, and currently operating one even after the waiver expired that just hasn't been dealt with by federal regulators.
Is Channel 9 the one
WWOR
that serves New Jersey? And he also owns Channel 5.
That's correct. And he owns the New York Post. And so it took a waiver to be able to do that. You know, at a certain time, you know, Murdoch was prevented from owning the New York Post. He came in as a hero hailed by leaders of both parties, David Dinkins and Rudy Giuliani, to save it because it wasn't making money.
I remember when Mario Cuomo was governor and he presided over the deal that allowed the special dispensation for Murdoch to own more media outlets in one city than the law usually allows to save the New York Post at that time.
And if there's any politician who might have cause for resentment against Rupert Murdoch, it might well be Mario Cuomo, because Cuomo's New York Post picked Ed Koch almost out of the ether to support and champion
in 1977 for mayor of New York
against
Mario Cuomo.
There you go.
Last thing then. The title of the book is Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Do you think there will be no more Rupert Murdoch type figures in the future as we are now obviously transitioning into the new media age?
I think the new media age will almost certainly usher in new media titans, but they're going to be of a different nature. You see guys like Jeff Bezos take over the Washington Post, you know, Bezos of Amazon, Chris Hughes, a Facebook billionaire of some sort and former operative for the Obama campaign in 2008, bought the ailing New Republic magazine. A guy named Pierre Omidyar, the co-founder of eBay, has said he's going to willing to lavish a couple $100 million to create a news organization from scratch. You're seeing a lot of energy, a lot of confidence being brought forward by these billionaires to say, hey, you know, you guys had your chance. It's time for a new generation.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, whose new book is Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Very illuminating. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks so much, Brian.